Are we off the air now?
Yeah, we're done.
Okay.
I mean, we're still talking. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I am your host for today's exciting episode. My name's Todd Conklin, and I'm sure glad you're listening. It's going to be an interesting day, that's for sure. Lots going on. I don't know if you can tell, but September has hit us. I've lamented the end of summer long enough. Now I'm going to enjoy the beginning of the winter, which is filled with snow. And according to the Farmer's Almanac, it's going to be a big one. At least it is for our part of the world. Or that's what I heard. So I don't really pay that much attention. But, you know, any guidance is guidance if you figure it out. Working on a big presentation on high reliability for large organizations, and that's always fun. I like the chance to think about different stuff in a different way, and that always gives me a chance to do that. And that's kind of what today's podcast is going to be about, too. This is a podcast that has been in the works a long time. I have tried everything in my power to get this guy to talk to us, and he is very humble and very concerned and worried that he wasn't going to have anything to say, which lots of people say when they do the podcast. But you'll see that that's exactly not going to be the problem with this podcast. How are you? What's going on with you guys? Anything exciting? Because it's probably worth talking about, and it's probably worth picking your brain a little bit on what's new, what are you thinking, what do you need? Anybody have any suggestions or ideas for people that ought to be on the podcast that would fill our brains with new ideas and give us things to think about and move us in a direction that we see as forward and thoughtful and stimulating? Dr. Decker has kindly agreed to come back on the podcast, so he'll be back on the podcast. I think I'm going to pull Jim Barker back up. I've thought about that a bunch. I should probably warn him before I say it on this podcast, but I'll drop him an email and ask him if he'll talk to us more about complexity in organizations, because the more you look at human performance, kind of new view safety, system safety, and really this notion of high reliability or reliable systems, the more you realize that catastrophic failure and complexity are kissing cousins, and that really what we deal with is complex organizations that have many failure modalities, and they're all ready to fail pretty much all the time, and how we successfully defend against those failures being successful, kind of like cars. I mean, I think about cars all the time. Probably the most complex things you do on a daily basis for sure is drive your vehicle. Now, driving is maybe not a complex operator task, but the environment in which you drive offers many, many complexities, certainly complexities beyond planning, beyond work control. Things that you can't imagine happen all the time when you're driving. And so you think about how you manage that complexity and how you make things go, and that's a big part of it as well. The other thing is that we just had a recent shooting, and these shootings are interesting because they make me think about that meeting point between safety and violence and reliability and social pressures and society and politics and emotions and all of those things. I reintroduced Mark McElhaney's podcast to sort of talk directly to that because I thought it was timely, and it is pretty timely. Now, this will be a kind of a month out, so the shooting would have happened a month ago. But things are really going on and happening that give us pause. But mostly, I think the community that we're building is really working well. And I want to thank you for being a part of that, because it's really nothing if you're not a part of it. It's been a great journey for me. Goodness me. I have learned a ton. And I continue to learn, and that's good as well. New book coming out, in case you're wondering. I put together a book that's going to be called Better Questions. And it's at the publisher, and the case studies, the scenarios that are a part of this Better Questions, I actually picked on the brain of Bob Edwards to craft those and put those together. So it's a really interesting book on how we think about operational learning and how we actually use operational learning in the field. Other than that, Gosh, I can't even wait to see you. I hope I run into you someplace, maybe at the big hop meeting, or maybe in an airport someplace, or maybe someplace I'll see you. That'll certainly be a part of what happens. Until then, let's talk about the podcast for today. Today's podcast features a guy named Alan Frankfurt. He's a physician, and he's going to talk to you about the journey he went on, gosh, 6 or 7 or even 8 years ago, to creating higher reliability in the work he does. You're going to really like Alan. He's a super smart guy, and I'm pretty willing to bet you you're going to listen to this podcast a couple times. It's that kind of podcast. So without much more fanfare at the beginning and a little more conversation at the end of the podcast, here is Alan Frankfurt and his discussion on reliable systems.
It seems like one of the things that happened to me is I did this thing that was called reliability before I really knew symptoms, or I kind of did it before I knew what I was even doing. I didn't have a name for it.
But don't you think that makes it better in a way?
Yes, because I think what's a little bit wigging me out a little bit is now people almost expect to hear these phrases or terms or whatever. You know, all that kind of symptoms things, you know, when people talk about, you know, preoccupation with failure, there's that kind of catchphrase. Now, I know what we did when we operationalized it. I just didn't know that we were looking for small disruptions, perturbations, whatever in the system. I didn't know what to call it. We just, you know, it just seemed like the normal thing to do.
So one of the things that I think is interesting about teams that are really highly reliable is
are we doing this for real now?
Yeah, sure, we're totally doing it.
Oh.
Yeah, it's easy. One of the things that I think is so interesting about teams that are highly reliable is they don't ever know they're highly reliable. They never set off to do it on purpose. What they set off to do was to either solve a problem or become more stable, safer, more effective. And so the whole notion that you can look at the characteristics of high reliability and become them, I think is a huge mistake. I think highly reliable teams don't know they're highly reliable. They're constantly learning and improving. So what do you think?
No, I think you're right. What kind of made me feel better about what we kind of tripped into was Dr. White talked about the first time he, I think, was speaking with Admiral Mercer.
Right.
And Mercer didn't even know, Admiral Mercer didn't even know that what they were really doing was high reliability. I mean, this is just the way that they did business to make things safer. And the beauty of it was, is it was so dynamic. It's not that you simply, okay, I'm there, I'm highly reliable. The thing that is, for us, it is as much fun and it is as great an educational experience actually doing one of these big, complicated, life-threatening OB cases that we call accreta, where the placenta kind of grows into the uterus and is really a potentially life-threatening event. It's as much fun for us doing the case as it is in the debrief when we constantly are challenging each other to tease out where things didn't exactly go like we expected, and then also to reinforce the importance that each individual brings to the overall experiences we're doing it and the good outcomes that we've had. It is a living entity. It's like a biologic organism. You know, it's constantly morphing and dealing with new environmental threats. Maybe the air quality changes. Maybe you change your diet. Maybe you begin exercising. You stop exercising. There's all these stimuli that are coming into this living organism, and the organism begins to adapt to survive. From a science background, it's almost like a living entity.
I think that's actually a really, really good metaphor. It's a good way to sort of frame the discussion. How'd you get started on this? Give us sort of your story into high reliability.
Well, I do a lot of obstetric anesthesia. And if you look at the world population, the maternal obstetric world population, what women die from, primarily in third world countries, is they bleed to death. But it is still a very significant, I think it's the second or third most common cause of maternal death in the United States. And one night in 2008, we had a mom who at 2 o'clock in the morning had, I don't even want to call it a near miss. I mean, we got by the skin of our teeth. I mean, she circled the drain and I thought, okay, this is it. I've had a perfect record for 25 years and now this lady's going to die in front of my eyes. I mean, she was bleeding. And so in an attempt to get adequate blood products from the blood bank, which was in a different part of the hospital, they had never been in the operating room with me. They had their own set of rules, regulations, paperwork, and so forth. I got on the phone with blood up to my ankle saying, I need blood as much as you can give me right now. And they said, make a request in the computer. I said, you don't understand. I'm up to my ankles in blood. And they said, put a request in for the computer. And we were talking two different things. They didn't understand my world. And honestly, I didn't understand their world. And so between the new resuscitation strategies coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan, and then understanding that what we were doing, we were going to kill somebody. Sooner or later, we were going to kill somebody. We needed to fix the problem. And they needed to understand what I was dealing with. I needed to understand what they were dealing with. And really from there, we developed, and we've talked about this term before, we had a shared mental model. We had a sense of reality that we shared together that was accurate and allowed us to now come together to solve those problems. I brought them into the operating room. They got to see what we were dealing with. They got to understand a little bit more about maternal hemorrhage. I got to go over to the blood bank and understand what their rules and regulations from the American Blood Banking Association was. We sat down together and started figuring out how we could make this a win-win deal, how we could get blood to me as quickly as possible, but at the same time meet their needs to make sure they didn't deliver the wrong blood, which is what they were scared of. And so it was just an educational process where we – I think the Germans called it Schwerpunkt, which was it was an actionable filter. How did we come together as a group of physicians, nurses, blood bankers, and make sure that everything that we did on a go-forward basis allowed us to get blood to the operating room to deal with a life-threatening maternal hemorrhage quicker? And so once we were on the same page, heading in the same direction, life got easier and it probably got safer.
That's amazing.
Well, I don't know. I worked with some great people and we destroyed vertical silos. We created horizontal integration. Now I didn't know we were doing this at the time.
Right.
But
right.
Hospitals and other organizations are built on vertical silos. And as you know, I spent a lot of time in the military. There's not a more traditional vertical siloed organization in the world, probably. But those vertical separations, those vertical silos keep us from talking to each other and allowing us to understand what keeps us from being as good as we can get.
How'd you make it sustainable? I mean, how'd you keep it so it sustained so that it became coded into the DNA of the hospital?
Because we're all there. The pharmacists, the nurses, the blood bankers, the anesthesia people, the obstetricians, the surgeons, we're there because we have similar DNA. We have dedicated our lives to helping people. We wanted to be that person that was there for somebody else. And so particularly with these kinds of cases, which were potentially life-threatening, as I mentioned, people took ownership of it. They wanted to do this anyway. They just needed that reliability champion who was not going to take no for an answer. And I'm not blowing smoke at myself. I'm just saying that it stays a living entity because I would not let it get sick and die. And then the more success we got, the more people got invested, the more people refused to not do it this way. It was really interesting. We worked with an obstetrician a couple of weeks ago on one of these high-risk cases. And he came up to one of the nurses after he went to one of our pre-briefs where everybody gets to understand about the case. They begin to develop or acquire ownership of this patient now. He pulled one of the nurses off to the side and he said, you know, the problem with you folks is you really think this is your patient. It's my patient. No, he's going to be a challenge and he's going to need to begin to internalize and believe it really is our patient. And it's not just his patient. But I thought it was a good example of what we run up against now, less and less common. But really, when we do these cases now, 8 times out of 10, the obstetrician and the surgeon come to our pre-brief, which includes everybody, blood banker, blood bank people, nurses, the scrub tech, everybody who's going to be involved to any degree has equal ownership of this patient.
Are those pre-briefs formalized? I mean,
yes.
Are they always the same? How did you develop those?
How did we develop it? I think I came up with a template. And part of the template was, what are the threats that are out there that can really derail us? Because we're moving this patient over a period of 8 hours throughout the hospital. She's pregnant and anesthetized. And as we started talking among ourselves where things could go wrong, we realized that it was critical to verbalize and to share our concerns and look for everybody to be part of the solution. So it was just the way we did business. I never took off in an airplane without walking around the airplane, making sure the wing wasn't going to fall off, didn't have a full tank of gas. And I looked at the next guy and said, hey, you know, the weather's hot, the altitude's high, we got a big load in the back. You know, here's what we're going to do if the engine goes out. And when we talked about things that could happen that could ruin our day. And so we started doing these pre-briefs because it was so complicated and there were so many moving parts. We started doing these pre-briefs on day one. And it's now just the way we do business. And we would not consider not doing a pre-brief, even though we've done a lot of them.
Right, right, right.
It's just part of how we do business.
And then you guys also do an after-action review, right? You do a post-job brief.
Every time.
And when does that happen, and what's it look like?
We try and do it as soon as possible after the case. We kind of have an unwritten rule that we never go more than 10 to 14 days afterwards because it gets harder and harder to bring everybody together. Usually within a week or so, we've got everybody, including the surgeon. And it's really important, what we found is for everybody to arrange their schedule around the surgeon, who is the person that brings the patient to us. So if he has to do it at 6:30 in the morning, or he has to do it at 5 o'clock in the afternoon because of his office and patients and so forth, that's when we do it. And we simply make this a priority.
Do you learn a lot? I mean, is it valuable?
Yes, I think it's valuable both from a medical point of view, because there's always something that somebody brings up that is less and less a technical issue, but there are always communication issues that come up. If for no other reason, it's important to reinforce that everybody's a team. Everybody has an important role in this. And I think by having the physicians there, it reinforces to everybody else how important it is. I think there are, to answer your question, I think a little bit better, there are medical and logistical issues that come up that we're always able to tweak. And then there's the issues that you really can't put your hands on. They're more, oh, I'm blanking out on the word, but it's that part of the process that keeps us a family. We always have the pharmacy there. We always have nursing. We always have anesthesia, which in this case is me, who's showing up. And it just reinforces the fact that, hey, we did a great thing. The patient did well. There's a few things we got to tweak. But, you know, what we have developed over the last 5 or 6 or 7 years, hey, it's working well. We did something really good a week ago. The patient's left the hospital. She left with a healthy baby. And I think it's important for those people on the team to have a positive reinforcement and a positive self-image of what they're doing, that what they're doing makes a difference in terms of how this young lady experienced this process.
That's pretty remarkable. So here's the big question. I don't even know what to ask, actually. There's two big questions, so let's just take them this way. What do we do to get other places as interested in this kind of improvement as you guys are?
I think that everybody who's gone into medicine, for the vast majority, want to be part of something like this. But as medicine has evolved, and certainly when I started this in 1980, and when I went into practice in 85 to now, the pressures are so much different. And many of them are logistical, scheduling, and financial. But even with all the financial challenges, there's still a huge line out the door for people signing up to be a physician for all the right reasons, and for nurses to be nurses for all the right reasons, and pharmacists to be pharmacists for all the right reasons. There's something inside of people who work in a hospital and certainly in the operating room environment. There's something inside of them that wants to have this experience of being part of something bigger than themselves and making a real difference, being part of this living organism. I think there are opportunities all over the hospital for someone to take ownership of a project, whether it's in the ICU, whether it's in the emergency room or wherever, and to tackle a safety problem or a patient threat problem, and to bring the right people together, share what they feel the threat is, to delineate the roles and goals of those people, to create a integrative process, to talk about what keeps you up at night if we fail or fail to address this, and then to train as a team. And I think you can use that template to conquer any of the problems that have popped up, whether it's something that hasn't been going well in your hospital, something that you are concerned about because you know there's all those, as you refer to, these small signals out there that are saying, you know, we're just biding time. It's going to happen, maybe not on my shift, but it's out there, to take ownership of this stuff.
Have we just not done a good job educating people or helping them understand that this is a way to think about it? I mean, I'm surprised it's not happening everywhere.
You know, the hospital that I work at is going to kick off a high reliability organization project in January. I don't know anything about it. What I think we've tended to do is come up with a set of slides that show a pyramid of some type.
Yes.
And say, we need to do better. We need to be reliable. To me, this just made common sense. As we've talked about, like I said, I've gotten to surround myself with a bunch of really talented people in the military whose job it was is to go into potentially dangerous environments and understand what the threats were and then train to those threats using very, very similar training aids and concepts that people like you and others have talked about. Operationalizing it, you just got to have somebody who drinks the Kool-Aid and won't say no. At the end of the day, somebody's got to take ownership of it and do it. And it's either got to be something that you've spent the time studying and trying, or this somehow in one's life, you've been exposed to it either through aviation or other aspects of the military or whatever, so that the tools that you've used all your life in different parts of your life now just become the normal way of doing business in a medical environment? I don't know if that's a great answer.
No, it's a great answer. So here's part two of that question. What would you tell people who wanted to become that person? What advice would you give them? How would you help people across the world make their patient reliability more stable? What's your hint?
I've got a template that I have spent some amount of time on, months, maybe a year, kind of trying to bring my thoughts together so that no matter what the issue is, the concept will work. And we've kind of touched on it before. I think the first thing you have to do is create shared purpose and trust. You have to have a shared mental model so that everybody that you've identified that needs to be on the team is marching down the same path. Whatever action you choose to undertake, and whoever chooses to undertake that, has to be able to explain to the team how that gets you one step closer to the goal line. So it's what I call an actionable filter. Everybody has to understand what the threat is, and there can be more than one. In our case, it was potential maternal death, a potential maternal admission to an ICU unnecessarily, a baby who goes home without a mom. Everybody has to understand what their role is and how that role fits into the ultimate goal, roles and goals. I think you have to spend the time integrating the team. And I don't mean just saying your job is X. I mean becoming a trusted family member. You know, we've all seen, you know, the Navy SEALs and so forth, and how difficult it is for them to get into that community. And they have something called BUDS, where they spend 6 weeks, the first 6 weeks of phase one, sitting in a bunch of cold water, getting dirty and sandy and rolling around carrying this huge log. But what they're doing is through a shared experience, they become a family. They can turn to each guy on their left and right and say, I'll trust that guy with my life. I think we have to understand and be able to communicate what our concerns are. I got a problem with this doc. I got a problem with this nurse. I have a problem with the way that we're doing this. And I think in medicine, it's always been the captain of the ship, the surgeon, and nobody raised their voice. And of course, you've seen this in aviation with crew resource management, all those crashes that happened because the co-pilot was scared to tell the pilot, hey, dude, the landing gear's not down. Everybody's got to be able to voice their concern, do away with vertical silos. Life becomes horizontal. I'm going to do my doctor thing. You're going to do your nurse thing. But I'm not any more important than you are. And then training what we need to train. Do we need to train how to get the blood to me quicker? Should we walk it? Should we turn it down the tube system? Let's go time it. Let's go find out. So we got to train and make sure that we're capable of implementing what we've decided to do and that we're doing it the right way. I want to find out if we're doing something wrong before I've got a patient laying there anesthetized in front of me. And I think we can use scenario play, which we've now begun to use in medicine quite a bit, to help figure out what's really working well and what's not.
Can other people contact you? Can other hospitals? Are you open to that?
Absolutely. I'm just a humble servant.
Yes, you are. What did you think? Was this too bad?
You know, I felt like I fumbled around a little bit.
No, you were great.
I thought we were going to do this tomorrow.
I'm tricking you.
I know. I'm glad you did, because tomorrow I would have been, you know, like fumbling worse.
But I know.
No, good. I think it was. I'm glad I got to share this, because this can be applied just about anything. It's so easy to do. And I don't mean to minimize it. It's just, we talked about this before. It's what people almost, I think, in many ways come to naturally, and at least in the medical field, it's how we want to be.
Yeah.
It makes it fun to do what we want to do.
What did you think about that one? Dr. Alan Frankfurt. So Alan's dug deeply into high reliability, systems reliability, human performance, new view. And he's dug deeply in his specific area of professional interest. I mean, what he does for a living, which is delivering babies, and how to make that system more reliable, and how to make that system more robust, and how to make that system more responsive. And who doesn't want that? I mean, goodness me. The payoff is super high, and the effect makes a huge difference, truly, touchably, in the lives of people. But I think the part of Alan that I like best of all is how he's just right there with us on this journey. He's humble. And highly reliable teams are always really humble. I mean, that's normal. I see that all the time. But I like how he's struggling next to us, beside us, in helping to understand how to make the world a better place. And, man, if you didn't listen to what he was saying, well, first of all, I'm mad at you, tisk, tisk. And secondly, go back and listen. You know, pre-job brief, post-job learning, shared sense of mission, right? I mean, all those things are you can do those in the operating room. You could also do them on the construction site and anywhere in between there. That was an incredible, incredible podcast. Thanks for your time, you guys. Thanks for listening as well. Tell your friends, if you get a chance, write a review on the podcast. I guess that makes a huge difference. They've asked me to ask you to do that, so there it was. I just asked you. I'll try to remember to do that again. Until then, learn something new every day. Have fun, by golly. And for goodness sakes, be safe. Keep listening, baby, and tell your friends.